You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lehmiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Imagine for a moment that your genitals were in a near constant state of arousal. You have nonstop pulsing and throbbing sensations, and it feels like you're always on the brink of orgasm. Some of you might be thinking, that doesn't sound too bad, but you'd be mistaken. For people who have what's known as persistent genital arousal disorder, these kinds of sensations are highly distressing. They're in a state of constant, unwanted arousal that occurs independently of sexual desire or stimulation, and there's almost no relief from it. This makes it difficult, if not impossible, to concentrate, to work, to sleep, to do almost anything in everyday life. We're talking about a truly debilitating condition here that, sadly, has even led some individuals to end their own lives. It really is that distressing. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to dive into what we know about persistent genital arousal disorder, including how common it is, what the symptoms can look like, what causes it, and how it's treated. As I mentioned, this is a condition that has been linked to suicide, so consider this just a quick content warning that this topic will come up a few times in this program. I am joined once again by Sue W. Goldstein, an ASEX-certified sexuality educator and clinical research manager at San Diego Sexual Medicine. Ms. Goldstein co-authored the book, When Sex Isn't Good, to provide education and empowerment to women with sexual dysfunction. She is also the managing editor of the journal, Sexual Medicine Reviews. This is going to be another fascinating conversation that you won't want to miss. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. If you love the science of sex as much as I do, consider becoming a friend of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. The Kinsey Institute is the world's premier research organization on sex and relationships, and you can help them continue the legacy of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, whose pioneering research changed everything we think we know about sex. Visit kinseyinstitute.org to make an impact. Your donations can help support ongoing research projects on critical topics. You can also show your support by following Kinsey Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for supporting sex science. Okay, Sue, let's talk about persistent genital arousal disorder. Now, some people might hear that term and think, gosh, persistent genital arousal, that doesn't sound all bad, but they'd be wrong. So let's start with the definition. What is persistent genital arousal disorder?
So I'm not going to give you the formal definition. I'll give it in ways that people can understand. It's that you feel like you're constantly aroused on edge without any kind of stimulation, physical or mental stimulation. It's just that constant feeling. And it may be that it's your clitoris that feels aroused. We actually have broadened PJD to include genitopelvic dysesthesia because you may be that you feel itching. It may be that you feel arousal towards your anus. It's far more than just your clitoris being aroused. And it has to be for at least 3 months. It has to cause distress. But it's a very devastating situation. If it gives you pleasure, then it's not persistent genital arousal disorder. It's just persistent genital arousal. The disorder means that it caused you to distress.
Yeah. So we're talking about some type of persistent arousal in the genital region that is not caused by sexual stimulation and you're not getting enjoyment from, and it's just not going to go away. So can you give us like an example of what this might look like in daily life or the effects that it has on an individual? So what does it look like in practice?
Yeah, it's devastating. So we have a second grade teacher who has this, and she has to slip into the ladies' room between classes to masturbate to relieve some of that constant pressure. But if anyone at her school knew as a second grade teacher that she was doing that, she would lose her job. I have another patient who literally can't get out of bed because she has to masturbate for several hours before she can function. I have another patient who is a male who, if he masturbates about 25 times before he leaves his house, then he figures he can get an hour or two with his pants on without ejaculating while he's walking down the street. It very much interferes with life if it's left untreated.
Yeah. And so it sounds like masturbation for some of these folks might be a way of providing temporary relief. And I think we got to make a clear distinction here that this is not about compulsive masturbation. It's masturbation as a way of trying to provide temporary relief so that you can just get on with your day or do normal things that other people do, because you've got this persistent arousal that won't go away. And it's so incredibly distressing. And sometimes masturbation is the only temporary relief that they can find for it, right?
That's right. And if your symptoms are not clitoral arousal or penile arousal, then you don't even have that option. It may be that you constantly have that feeling, you know, anywhere in your genitals, in your pelvis, it can be in your anus. For some people, they can function. For some people, it is so distracting, they really can't do anything else. There obviously are different levels. Some people have flares, and during their flares, they need to stay home. And when they're not flaring, they can, you know, go to work, go to school. But for a lot of our patients, what we try to do is figure out what's triggering it. I'm kind of jumping ahead, but there are two goals. The goal would be to cure the problem. And the next goal is to control the problem so that they can function.
So how long have we known about persistent genital arousal disorder? Like, how long has this been on our radar? I mean, I know when I was back in graduate school and I was first starting to teach human sexuality courses, like, it seemed very anecdotal. There were only a couple case reports here or there. And that was like 15 or so years ago. But since then, I feel like I've seen quite a bit more on this, more attention to it. So what's our sense of like the history of this? Is this just something we're finally catching up to or realizing as a thing?
Well, Sandra Liebman first identified it in 2001, persistent sexual arousal syndrome. When we came to realize that it wasn't sexual, that name was changed. But, you know, if you build it, they will come. And as we publish more and more, then people come out of the woodwork as they're able to self-identify. So it was renamed persistent genital arousal disorder, genital pelvic dysesthesia, a couple of years ago. And we did that for one reason, is genital pelvic dysesthesia is a safer medical word. It's not embarrassing for people to say, but we had to keep the persistent genital arousal disorder portion because the new chapter on sexual medicine in the ICD-11 identifies PGAD. So we needed to keep that language because for the first time, it will be a diagnosis. Something like 6% of people have PGAD, but as we publish more and more, as I say, they come out of the woodwork. One of the things that really changed the whole approach is that the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health put together a consensus panel. They took 2 years and published a seminal article on this. It changed our approach not only to how we diagnose and treat PGAD, but really how we do it for all of our arousal and orgasm issue, or I guess desire, arousal, orgasm issues. We've divided the body into 5 regions. So region 1 are the genitals, region 2 is the pelvis perineum, region 3 is the cauda equina, region 4 is the spine, and region 5 is the brain. And when you have PGAD, for some reason, and we don't know why, you have a predisposition that things will affect you differently. And so we have to look and find out, do you have a trigger in region 1 and region 2? You could have multiple triggers, and then we have to treat one at a time each of those triggers. The other scary thing is that stress will always trigger. So if you have that predisposition, even if your problem was caused because you have an annular tear in your spine, which we've found is, I don't want to say common, but we've seen that in a lot of patients, and our spine surgeon that we work with will do that repair and you're better. But the moment you're in a stressful situation, that will flare. So it's partly eliminating the biologic triggers and partly trying to eliminate stress or decrease stress in your life. So it gets very complicated, and we can't always find what those biologic triggers are. So in the meantime, we have to provide things like very low dose Ambien, Zolpidem, so that they can keep that, sort of keeps it at a level so that, you know, the 20-year-old can finish college or the 40-year-old can go to work. So it's a matter of finding the problem, fixing what we can, and then, for lack of a better word, you know, using a drug to try to keep that level down enough that people can tolerate. But suicide is a huge problem with PGAD. Every year we read about, you know, one or two people who have killed themselves because they can't exist like this. And they get medically gaslighted when they go to anybody.
Yeah, you know, this has me thinking about how, you know, while this might be a relatively new diagnosis, it's probably not a new phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination. And people probably had this for decades or hundreds of years. And it makes me wonder if, like, if you went back into the past, you know, people who were labeled or described as like chronic masturbators, if you will, might have been people who had persistent genital arousal disorder and they were just trying to seek relief from it for a medical condition. They didn't have any other way of dealing with it. But then as a result of that masturbation, they were, you know, diagnosed as mentally insane, or they had some barbaric treatments applied to them to get them to stop masturbating or stop touching themselves. And so,
or burned at the stake as a witch.
Yeah. So it makes me wonder how in the past this might have been viewed through a very different lens, through like an overly sexualized lens, as opposed to the medical condition that it is, and treated in just very terrible ways.
I totally agree with you. With a colleague, I wrote a history of sexual medicine. We wonder if the nymphomania that was diagnosed, you know, thousands of years ago, if this is nymphomania, or as you say, you know, chronic masturbators. So we have to be very careful when we label people, because it's easy to say, well, they masturbate all the time, but let's find out, why do they masturbate all the time? And is it something that we can help them with? It's so important. I think giving the name genital pelvic dysesthesia has really helped the PJD community, because now they have a name to their problem. This big paper by ISWISH is open access, so anybody can download it, take it to their doctor anywhere in the world, and at least legitimize it. And if your doctor laughs at you, go find another doctor.
That's good advice in general. If your doctor laughs at you, find a new doctor, because yeah, too many people have bad experiences feeling dismissed or trivialized in the medical system.
Well, worse than that, there are doctors that have said to our PGAD patients, oh my gosh, I wish my wife had that. Can you imagine? Their lives are destroyed. They would give anything not to have that. They'd be perfectly happy never having sex again. They come in, we had a patient who wanted her clitoris cut off. If these people are in their arousal state and we do an examination, their clitoris is actually not aroused. There's no engorgement in 99% of the cases. It's the message that's going to the brain has been warped somewhere. And it's very often that it's warped in the cauda equina. There are three different nerves that braid at the cauda equina. They all meet, and we'll do neurologic testing. And if they're all abnormal, then the only place it could be a problem is in that location. So then we look at the lumbar and sacral MRI. Barry Karmazurek published in 2012 that looking at the incidence of Tarlef cysts in the PGAD community versus the general community, and it was more than double. So that's the first time that anybody realized that, oh my gosh, there could be a physiologic cause from that. And that made us start to look. In 2016, we had a woman come to us from Denmark with PGAD. We couldn't help her at the time. She had actually signed up for assisted suicide in Switzerland, and she did go home and she did kill herself. But in the meantime, what we learned since 2016 to now is that we look at MRIs. And we don't just look at the MRI report. Our spine surgeon totally understands that a very small annular tear, which normally is considered incidental, or a very small Tarlef cyst that would be considered incidental, can cause this miss signal to your brain that's interpreted as the arousal or the itch or the pain, or that can feel like cut glass. You know, there's so many different sensations that they can feel. And then it's not actually happening, but the brain interprets it that, and it could be because of one of those problems. You know, that's just one example. We actually have two women who had vestibular issues. The vestibule can cause pain, but in their case, the vestibule caused the persistent genital arousal disorder. And you have to remove the vestibule, which is not a big deal, and that sounds very callous, but it's a surgery that we do a lot for women with pain. And removing the vestibule will not totally take away their PJD, because they still have all the other things going on, the stress and things, but that's their main trigger. So we're learning every day more and more triggers, a pudendal nerve, something in the brain. And the trick is to go through methodically, and that's why we published with the five regions, to go through methodically and try to figure out which of the areas are triggered, and then what can we do to stop those triggers.
That is so fascinating that this is called persistent genital arousal disorder, but the genitals themselves might not actually be showing physiological signs of arousal, right? Because it might be about some miscommunication or misfiring to the brain. And you mentioned the term cauda equina a few times. For people who might not be familiar with medical terminology, just what are we talking about there?
So at the base of the spine, when you're born, your nerves run through the spine, and then they sort of hang out the bottom so they can go down your legs, go to your genitals, go to your pelvis. And as you grow, the spine grows with you, but the nerves that are hanging out of the bottom, quadrant equine means horse's tail, they don't grow. They just continue to stretch. And so they come together in a braid form as they enter the spinal canal. And that's the quadrant equine is right there where it's entered. So that's why we look at the lumbar and sacrum, which is the lower part of the spine. And it's literally, if there is something bulging out, it can cause an irritation, whether it's a little bit of the annulus that leaks out that causes irritation, whether you have a tarlop cyst that pushes on it that causes irritation. The nerve runs from your legs, from your genitals, your anus, your pelvis, to your brain. And if anything's pushing on that, for normal people, they might just feel sciatica. But for somebody who has the predisposition to have PGAD, they can feel any of those issues that we're talking about, whether it's genital arousal or the cutting feeling. But yeah, it's pretty phenomenal.
Thanks for explaining that. That makes it make a lot of sense in terms of how this might happen. And it could be about just pressure being put on nerves somewhere in the body that's then being translated into the brain as this persistent genital arousal. So you mentioned that it could be as much as 6% of the population who might experience PGAD. I think there's been very few studies that have looked at prevalence. I can think of one other study I cited in my textbook. I think it was around 4%, but 4 to 6% would still put it at about 1 in 20 people in the population, which would make it kind of a lot of people who might experience this.
I could be off. I haven't looked at the paper in a while, so I could be a little bit higher. But even if it were 1% of the population, that's a huge amount. Carolyn Percal has done some work on that up in Queens. She has the literature on the prevalence.
Yeah, I think it was 4% was what I seem to recall from her research, but it's a significant amount no matter what it is.
Yes, yes.
So do we know anything about gender differences in this? So when you see it clinically, is it more women than men or is it kind of equally distributed?
We see more women coming to our office, but we see other conditions that we believe are actually sort of the same thing. In men, the men will present with sleep-related prolonged erections. They'll present with hard flaccid syndrome, which are different, but maybe based on some of the same concept. We do see some men with PGAD, but we see it more oftenly in women. I don't remember the numbers from Carolyn's paper offhand, to be honest, but it's more verbally we see more women. And the suicides, I don't recall ever seeing a male. I believe everything I've ever seen has been female.
So something else I wanted to ask about this is how in men PGAD is different from priapism. So priapism is the term that refers to permanent erection. It can happen for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes you just take too much of like Viagra, or you have too much of one of those vasodilator shots that give you an erection, or it can be related to other things. But how is this similar to or different from priapism?
Well, first I want to correct something. You cannot get a priapism from any of the oral medications, Viagra or any of the rest of them, because you have to have sexual stimulation at the same time. So the moment you stop looking at that pretty girl or that pretty guy, whatever you're interested in, your erection is going to go down. But yes, if you have the wrong injection and you don't have a reversal, priapism is an erection that does not go down. And then because the erection is there and the blood is trapped in the penis, it doesn't allow for fresh blood to come in to allow oxygen to come in. And over time, if you don't get any oxygen in there, the corpora cavernosa, the smooth muscle will atrophy. It'll become scar tissue, and then you have erectile dysfunction. So that's a very different situation than somebody that gets an erection without wanting an erection, and then it will go down, or you masturbate, and then later on you get another erection. The difference is it's different from stuttering priapism, which is a situation where you get a priapistic situation, and then it goes away, and then so it's like it's hard. It's a different disease state than PGAD. PGAD does not cause any damage from that point of view. The damage we've seen is, for instance, the young man that I told you about at the beginning who masturbated for 2 hours straight, he literally sloughed the healthy skin off the surface of his penis because he was having to masturbate so much. So then you're subject to infection and things like that. He's the only case I've heard of that, but it's very different.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. So, in terms of treatment for all of this, I think you kind of mentioned this, that it's really going to depend on the individual. You've got to do a thorough assessment because you have no idea just initially when they come in what it is that might be causing it. So you got to figure out what are the triggers. And then based on the individual, depending on what the trigger is, the treatment might be very different.
And we still have patients that we've been working with for multiple years that we cannot figure the trigger. And it's really hard because they're suicidal. you know, they're in their 20s, 30s, they don't want to spend the rest of their lives like this. And we totally appreciate that. But unfortunately, until we can figure out what's going on, and we tell our patients, we don't give up on our patients. What we didn't know in 2016, when that woman went back to Switzerland to kill herself, we know so much more now. And I'd like to think that 10 years from now, we'll know so much more again. So for people who have PGAD, don't give up. But, you know, for people who know someone with PGAD, I think the biggest problem is they can't feel like they can share this information. And so they don't have any kind of support system. Not only do their local physicians typically not know anything about it, but they don't feel comfortable sharing it with their friends. And so they have no support system. Emotional support system is so important. And then, you know, when you have stress, if you can share that with a partner, share that with a friend, that helps with the de-stressing. But if there's no one you can talk to, and so that makes it doubly hard. So at least giving the name GPD allows people to be able to be a little more open. But, you know, we're still in a situation where there's a lot of discomfiture around the whole conversation. How many people really want to find out that their friend is masturbating every day in order to leave the house? I mean, is that a conversation that people are even comfortable having? We live in a world where our genitals are shameful. We can't use the real words. I mean, when Oprah Winfrey said, oh, we have a vajayjay. Well, what is a vajayjay? And women use the word vagina to mean everything. You know, in a world that we let are shameful, can people with sexual problems even talk about things? They don't even know the right words. And they believe, I mean, there's research that's shown that when you go to your doctor, if you want to talk about sexual health issues, you're pretty sure your doctor's going to be embarrassed. And so you don't want to bring it up. So you want your clinician to start the conversation. And how many clinicians other than specialists ever start that conversation?
Not many. And so, you know, it brings me to my last question. So if you're somebody who might be struggling with this, or it could be with any sexual difficulty or dysfunction, and you're having trouble finding a provider who is knowledgeable of your condition or is sex positive, like where do you go to look for a qualified sex therapist or sexual healthcare provider?
You really need a therapist and a biologic provider. I'm going to put a shameless plug in for San Diego Sexual Medicine, where I work. And what we offer is a free 10-minute courtesy call. There's no charge. There's no obligation to become a patient. But it's an opportunity to speak with Dr. Goldstein, talk about what your issues are, and then he can sort of point you in the direction. You know what? You really need to get an MRI. Send it to us, and maybe you want to come to us. Or you know what? It sounds like that Dr. So-and-so in your region might be able to help you. You know, we can't promise to help everybody else, but it's a start. And at least somebody who will listen and say, you know what, it sounds like it must be this. Someone who's never going to laugh at you, who's going to, you know, hopefully be able to help. And then if you want to choose to become a patient in San Diego Sexual Medicine, that's your choice. But at least it's a start. And the other thing is, as I said earlier, that to download the ISWISH paper on PGAD GPD and bring that to your local doctor and see if he or she is willing to work with you to help.
Yeah. Sometimes, unfortunately, the patients have to do the job of educating their providers because sometimes the providers just never learned about this stuff in medical school or wherever they did their training.
We didn't know it then. We didn't know it then. And not everybody wants to learn new information, and not everybody belongs to societies like ISWISH where they would have access to this new information. So I always say to patients, don't blame your provider. They're doing the best he or she can. You be your own advocate and you teach him or her, so that maybe they can help the next patient.
Love that. And those are important words. So thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Sue. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you. I work at San Diego Sexual Medicine. You can go to sdsm.info to find out more about what I do and what we do at our practice. I am a clinical researcher and I am a sexuality educator, and I love talking to people about their sexual health. And, you know, if you want to come to San Diego, I look forward to meeting you. And thank you for having me, Justin.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here and hearing your wisdom. Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.